Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to those on the webcam as well. Well, as everyone is aware, after services today is the Bible chat. And one of the wonderful parts about that activity, is that we can come together and collectively talk about perspectives and ideas that each of us individually might not have thought of or considered. So today I'm going to ask you to bring your A game for the sermon chat, or maybe since the Olympics are on, you have to bring your gold medal game instead, because I'm really interested to hear everyone's perspectives on the topic that I did not consider. To set the stage for the sermon today, I want to turn back to Isaiah chapter 11. You can turn back there, Isaiah chapter 11. This is one of several scriptures that we're going to be turning to over the course of the sermon that we often frequent during the Feast of Tabernacles, because these are wonderful millennial scriptures, scriptures that point to a period of time where God is directly interacting with physical human beings on earth. And although God had a relationship with Adam and Eve at the beginning, and he certainly had relationships with people all through time, there will be nothing quite like this, either before or after, where God is interacting in such a direct and deep personal way for physical human beings in their physical lives. And it's a remarkable change that has never been seen up to this point. Let's see about what ways. Let's investigate here in Isaiah chapter 11, starting in verse 1. Isaiah 11, verse 1, it says, "There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. His delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears." Now, we're going to keep going in this chapter, but I don't want it to slip by us just yet that it's already describing a pretty substantial change. Now, it's easy for it to get lost in this chapter because it goes on and it talks about the changing characters of animals, and that's a pretty big one. But even up to this point, the characteristics of judgment itself will change. Verse 3, "And he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with a rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist." Verse 6, "The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, who shall stand as a banner to the people, for the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious." Well, this is not an exhaustive list of changes that one can expect in the millennium. The Bible, as we are no doubt aware, gives us just enough to whet our appetite, but not all the details that we might like to know. But in this chapter, we see that the way judgment and mercy are metered out will be changed. We see that the natural state of animals themselves will be changed. We'll see the characteristics of human behavior changing. We see judgment and equity, even knowledge of the Lord and his way of life generally being spread around. I want to go to one other example, and these are fun to read because they're so hopeful and wonderful scriptures. This one in Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. This is probably a memory verse for many. But again, just focus on the changes that are being described here. Isaiah chapter 2, picking it up in verse 2, it says, "Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. These are big changes, huge changes all the way around. Kind of hard to fathom changes as well, because it's so different than what we experience today. And it's definitely different than what mankind has experienced throughout history. And we know that the full fulfillment of these visions and these scriptures can only be accomplished with the complete wholesale changes brought on by God. We understand that leading up to this millennial period, mankind will have put themselves in a very precarious situation through wars and pestilence and the like. Jesus Christ will be required to return to the earth in order to prevent mankind from wiping themselves out. So at that point, the world will be at the lowest point it could possibly be, and then God will implement changes that will bring about the peak of the physical world, where things are running in the way that they were designed to be. There will be nothing like it before, and nothing quite like it in the future, at least not for physical human beings. But I want to ask you a question today. Then afterwards, I'm going to go through a couple of examples for the balance of the message, but I encourage you to write it down because I'm trying to prime the pump for the sermon chat afterwards. The question is this: can we, as human beings, ever get close to these millennial scriptures by working on incremental changes over time? Or does it require God's radical wholesale changes? Now, let me rephrase this in maybe a slightly different way. Let's say, just as a thought experiment, we're all suddenly transported into positions of authority where we could pass laws, we could form committees, we could implement plans and strategies, not just at a national level, but at an international level. And if that's the case, could we move incrementally closer to God's way of life on a physical level? Could we move that needle any closer to the examples we read about in Isaiah chapter 11 or Isaiah chapter 2? And again, we know that the full fulfillment of these verses are only possible with God's direct involvement on a spiritual level and of a change of human heart from a heart of stone to a heart of flesh, and for God's Holy Spirit to be involved as the very character of men and women are changed. We get that. But God did lay out plans for physical Israel, right? He did give them instructions on how to run a physical, civil society. And certainly his principles are the same now as they will be in the millennium, and as the same as they were back when he gave them. So is it possible to move mankind closer to what those verses in Isaiah are all about, and others, by working to implement and putting into practice the principles he gave us for civil, physical Israel? Further along in Isaiah, this time in Isaiah chapter 32, verses 16 through 18, I'm just going to read these three verses. Again, it's Isaiah 32, 16 through 18. It says, then justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. The work of righteousness will be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. My people will dwell in peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings, and in quiet, restful places. Those are admirable goals. Are they obtainable? Well, some would argue, myself included, that mankind has made a lot of progress in a lot of different ways. Let's take a few examples. Let's use global poverty, for example. That is a big worldwide problem. Extreme poverty is designated as someone that makes less than $1.90 a day. That's what they use as the purchasing power, and then they follow that through time to try to get a sense of how many people have lived in extreme poverty. In 1820, nearly 90% of the people lived in extreme poverty. In 2015, only 10% do. That's a big improvement. Well, what about literacy? In the year 1800, 88% of people were illiterate. In 2016, only 14%. That's change. That's progress. Also in the year 1800, 43% of children died in the first 5 years of their life. 43%. That's outrageous. Now it's 4%. That's a big positive change. Well, even in the shorter term, we continue to make iterative progress on a lot of different things. When I moved out to Virginia to start my career in the year 2000, since that time, the amount of people that have access to clean water has gone up 10 percentage points. That's fantastic. That same amount are the people that now have access to clean or to power and electricity that never had it before. Air pollution deaths have fallen for 27 straight years in a row. And even though it dipped recently in the U.S., global life expectancy has increased 57 years in a row. So it is possible to make iterative changes for the better, for the quality of life for physical human beings. That is demonstratively true. The famous Chinese philosopher Confucius, from a few hundred years before Christ, he wrote this. He said, quote, "The man who moves a mountain begins by carrying away small stones." So, what about it? Is it possible for mankind to pick up one stone at a time and to slowly and collectively improve to the point where the physical world pictured in Isaiah is within reach? Or is it required that God come in and move the whole mountain at once? Is it possible if we can get Greg elected as president, if we can get Brittany over at the UN, if we can get Sarah at the World Bank, is it possible that we can move the ship just a little closer to the ideal destination? Or are God's principles so foreign that they would just be rejected outright? Well, today, I want to focus on two areas that specifically must be changed. And they are currently very different than the way that God designed and the way that they will be in the millennium. But we could talk about a whole host of different systems. We could talk about the healthcare system, government, education, entertainment, any number of those. In fact, you could save them for, I don't know, like a Bible chat even. But today, I want to drill down into just two specifically. The two I want to cover are the judicial and the financial system. And the reason why I picked those two is because there are very clear examples in the Bible of what God intended and what God will restore in the millennium. But to make it more interesting, we can't cheat here. And what I mean by cheating is we can't just point to the parts that are obviously broken, like parts that everyone thinks are broken, and just set them up as straw men for us to tear down. For example, we all know that the prison system in the United States is currently busted. There are over 2 million prisoners in the U.S. this last year. We would easily take the gold medal in terms of number of prisoners and the percentage of population that is incarcerated. The second highest nation with incarceration rate is Turkey, and we're crushing them by like over 50%. The United States, we don't do anything halfway. But that's cheating to me because we all realize that that's broken. No one thinks that that system's working. We just can't agree as a nation on how to fix it. Instead, I want to frame this whole conversation around the fact that we are in charge. In our hypothetical world, we are calling the shots. Is it possible to incrementally improve these two systems, not just by fixing the busted parts, but by changing the very way they work and function and to model them after the system that God designed? So let's just dive in, shall we? Let's start first with the judicial system. That's the first aspect I want to go to. And one of the interesting concepts that I want to point out just right away, and it's not just about the judicial system, it's across the board, is that just how progressive the Bible is in a lot of different ways. There are many attacks on the Bible from people that are critics of the Bible that say that it's just too old-fashioned, that it doesn't hold up to modern times, that it was just written for an ancient group of people and it couldn't possibly be applied to us today, that we are a much learned group of folks and that we have data and models and PhDs and all this stuff to make us smarter and better. But time and time again, it's demonstrated in real-world situations that the Bible is not only progressive when it was written, but in a lot of cases, it's much more radical and progressive than the systems we have in place today. Now, let me give you an example of this, and still within the context of the judicial system. Back in Moses' day and for generations before and for thousands of years afterwards, nations were ruled by kings, of course. And they created the laws, they enforced the laws, they decided what was right and what was wrong. And we'll think back to stories in the Bible like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel in the lion's den, and Esther and King Azarias. In all those cases, we have a story of a king reacting to something kind of strongly, passing a new law right on the spot, and then immediately putting it into action. And if you were alive at that time, and you got a great and wise king, well, that's great. But if you weren't, well, that was a lot of trouble, because they had absolute authority. They, as kings, did what they thought was right at the time, and they put it directly into action. They were the originators of what was right and wrong and the laws that governed it. So it was an entirely new way of thinking that the Israelites weren't to do that. The Israelites weren't to decide for themselves what was right or what was wrong. God gave them the laws and the principles, and they were to just enforce them and mediate between one another and implement those principles. And as a result, God created a system where, since the laws didn't originate from man, man couldn't just change it to suit it their own purpose. Even Ahab and Jezebel, which are widely regarded as some of the worst and corrupt leaders in the history of Israel, even they couldn't completely subvert this system. I want to turn back to an example quickly in 1 Kings chapter 21. You don't have to go quickly. I guess you could just turn at your normal pace. This is the story of Ahab wanting a vineyard that belonged to Naboth. We're not going to recount the whole story, but I think we get it. Naboth had this wonderful vineyard. It was probably the best grapes of all the land, but it was right next to the palace. And Ahab wanted that vineyard, and Naboth refused. And this was part of his family's ancestral land, so he was in the right to refuse this request. And when he did so, we'll remember Ahab pouts and he sulks around and this and that, because even as the king, he couldn't unilaterally do whatever he wanted. He was still accountable to the law. But his wife Jezebel comes to his evil rescue, and notice how she solves this problem. 1 Kings 21, and we'll pick it up in verse 8, 1 Kings 21, verse 8. And she, that's Jezebel here in this case, and she wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who were dwelling in the city with Naboth. And she wrote in the letters saying, proclaim a fast, and seat Naboth with a high honor among the people, and seat two men, scoundrels, before him to bear false witness against him, saying, you have blasphemed God and the king, and then take him out, stone him that he may die. Well, why didn't she just order Naboth's death? Well, why did she go through this elaborate process of getting liars to come in and make this case? Well, because she couldn't override the judicial system. She had to subvert it through false accusations. Even in the sad state that Israel was in at this time, even then, the remnant of the judicial system was in place that held all people accountable, including the king and queen, and they were still subject to it. Now, by this time in Israel, it was a very thin strand connecting it to God's initial purpose, but it wasn't yet fully broken. The system that God put in place was designed to hold all people accountable. Nathan had the authority to walk into King David's chambers and confront one of the most powerful rulers in the history of the nation of Israel. In many countries today, if someone were to do that and march right into the dictator or the ruler's office, they would be put in jail at best. Even in our own country, people in positions of power can maneuver themselves outside of authority and the accountability of the justice system. But that's not the only change. There are two big ones found in Deuteronomy chapter 19. This principle is also in Leviticus, but Deuteronomy chapter 19 brings it out in great context. Let's go there. Deuteronomy 19, we'll pick it up in verse 15. Deuteronomy 19, verse 15. It says, one witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or sin that he commits, by the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. We just read that Jezebel used two liars for that very reason. Verse 16, if a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men and the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priest and the judges who serve in those days. Again, no one is above accountability. Everyone has to stand and be held in account. Verse 18, and the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you. Now, this is a big one. Anyone can bring charges as long as there are some witnesses, but they better be telling the truth. Because it's not just that the case would be dismissed, as it is in our day, but rather the whole thing is turned on its head and it's applied back to the liar. But there's even more. Verse 20. And those who remain shall hear in fear, and hereafter they shall not commit such evil among you. Verse 21. Your eyes shall not pity. Life shall be for life, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. This eye for an eye, this tooth for a tooth, is a concept, like so many others in the Bible, is often misrepresented by biblical critics. They would point to this scripture and say that the Bible shows no mercy, that it's about exacting revenge to the fullest extent possible. There's another famous quote that is kind of vaguely attributed to Gandhi, that it's supposed that he said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world go blind. I think we've heard that. But this is actually a more profound principle and another a great example of where the Bible is more progressive than our system is today. It's not just that the punishment should exact every ounce from the offender, but rather that the punishment shouldn't exceed the crime. Rather than a commentary on the cruelty of the Bible, it's really an example of mercy shown within the judicial system. The offender must repay, and he must make it right, but he couldn't be buried in a punishment, especially for a minor crime, for which they could never recover. It's about restitution and making one whole so that the community can heal and move forward. Think about how much would have to change within our own judicial system if we just made those simple changes. In these few short verses that we read, God lays out a judicial system based on some core components. Equal enforcement, where everyone is accountable, involvement of witnesses, thorough investigation and strict punishment of false accusations, punishments that fit the crime, and restitution-based versus punitive-based judgments. Now, all of those are physical constructs. That doesn't even take into matters of the heart that require God's Spirit. That's not talking about mercy and righteous judgment. These are physical things that could be implemented. So back to our original question, would it be possible to make iterative changes in these areas to get closer to the judicial system that God intended? Or again, do we need God to come in and just wipe the slate clean and start from anew? In Zechariah chapter 8, verses 16 and 17, it really puts it in plain language here. Zechariah chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. This makes you think, well, surely everyone can agree with these ideas. Surely we can all be on the same page and move the ball forward. Zechariah 8, verse 16, it says, these are the things you shall do. Speak each man the truth to his neighbor. Give judgment in your gates for truth, justice, and peace. Let none of you think evil in your heart against your neighbor, and do not love a false oath. For these are the things that I hate, says the Lord. The judicial system that God intends is where everyone is treated equally and where no one is above it, where one values truthful witnesses and vigorously penalizes false witnesses, and where punishments fit the crime for restitution to take place so that the whole community can return back to their lives. Can we get there iteratively? Well, keep your thoughts close by because we're going to talk about them. Well, let's move on to the second aspect I want to cover. The second one is financial. This is one of my favorite aspects to think about. because as a small business owner, I pay a truckload of taxes. And the idea of paying just 10% sounds like a dream to me. But obviously, the financial system that God has in mind is not just about the tithe, that's certainly involved with it, but it's a holistic approach to resources and wealth management. And the Bible does have a lot to say about this topic. One author suggested that there were 2,300 verses in the Bible that were related to money and possessions. I didn't go and count them up. I just took her word for it. But no doubt there are a ton of scriptures throughout the Bible that address these areas. And not only that, you could really cherry pick almost any position on this topic by selectively pulling out a verse here or a verse there. So Christ said that it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom. So you could just pick that out and say, well, you can't be wealthy. Or Paul in his epistle to the Romans said to owe no one anything. So we could just pick that out and say, no one can have debts of any kind. Or Peter just pulled a coin out of a fish's mouth. So you could say that we need to treat fish like slot machines. But really, any possession or any position on wealth, you can find some scripture to support it in some way. From living this chaste life of poverty to being blessed with more riches than you can ever handle. But even so, God did outline some specific principles about the financial system to the nation of Israel that they were to adhere to. Now, I'm personally convinced that God is not always concerned with the finances of each individual person, but he is very much concerned with the financial system that was in place with Israel, and he will also enforce similar changes to the financial system in the millennium. Let's go back to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25. There are quite a few of these principles that God put into place that we can find here. I want to highlight a few of them starting in verse 8 of Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus 25 verse 8, it says, "You shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout your land." Verse 10. "And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee to you," or for you. "And each of you shall return to his possessions, and each of you shall return to his family." Again, this is another example of the Bible being much more progressive than it is in our own modern day society. I mean, can you imagine the cancellation of debts every 50 years? People being able to get out of negative situations and get a fresh start in this way. This single rule would require a rework of every major financial system in the world. Dropping down, verse 13, a few verses down to verse 13. "In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession. And if you shall sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor, and according to the number of years of crops, he shall sell to you. According to the multitude of years, you shall increase its price, and according to the fewer number of years, you shall diminish its price. For he sells you according to the number of years of the crops." Verse 17. "Therefore, you shall not oppress one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God." Now, what would be the purpose of this principle? I mean, was God dead set on the tribe of Zebulun occupying some sliver of land in ancient Israel? Well, maybe so. But to me, it seems like God is building in a safety valve that would allow people to reset. And I know that I mentioned our focus isn't to just regurgitate all the negative things in our world now, but just to use this as an illustration, the most common cause of bankruptcies in the United States, it's 66%, by the way, is from medical debt, including those that have health insurance. And Sarah and I, we got some exposure to how quick this can happen when we were going through Olivia's cancer treatment. When she was first admitted, they sat us down, they brought in some social workers, and they sat us down and they tried to outline all the auxiliary costs and impacts of a high cost, high activity treatment. And I remember in that first meeting, they sat down and they figured out what we both do for a living, and Sarah was working from home, thankfully. And they said, usually in this situation, both parents are working two jobs, that they have some savings, you know, not a lot, they're just average everyday people. But immediately one person has to quit because someone has to stay full time in the hospital. And so then when that happens, they start to fall behind on their obligations. And it doesn't take too long before they're evicted or that they lose their house. And then the stress of that situation causes the parents to divorce. And before you know it, it's wrecked two whole families because of that. As a result of that wrecked family, it can take years and sometimes never to dig out of that situation. And it's not because of anything that the family did wrong, but just because there is no way for them to reset and recover. Now, Sarah and I were incredibly blessed. We had a huge amount of support, and we escaped that situation. But unfortunately, it was not uncommon. We saw it play out with the other families that were in the hospital with us. Now, further on in this same chapter that we're reading, in verses 23 through 28, it talks about allowing the redemption of things that were sold out of necessity, a way for them to get back what they lost. Again, it's all about resetting, recovering, and bouncing back. And let's drop down to verse 35. Verse 35, still in Leviticus 25, verse 35 this time. It says, if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner. That's kind of interesting. That he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. Again, a safety valve is incorporated into the community to allow those that are poor or that need help a way to stay afloat. There are other scriptures that we won't turn to that add even more to this principle, that not only are you to not oppress the poor, but you're to proactively enable them. And it's not just about sharing and helping, which are obviously important as well, but also for granting opportunity. Now, for example, one famous story that we can recall is Ruth, when she went out into the fields so that she could reap food for her and Naomi to live. Now, Boaz was doing what God commanded by leaving those areas in his field where they were open, where she could go and harvest. But he didn't go cut it down and hand it to her, but it was made available so that she could go do it herself if she was willing and able. There was a spot for her. And then Boaz even goes above and beyond here to tell his workers to be just a tad bit more careless and drop some things so that she would have more opportunity if she was interested. Now, I do want to notice a comment by Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, this gets brought up a lot in this context. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, we'll start in verse 7. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 7. It says, for you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. Nor do we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you, not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you shall follow us. Verse 10, for even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Now, this is a solid biblical principle. We can find that throughout the Bible. Paul just says it a little bit more directly, and it means that you have to contribute. If you want to eat, you have to work. And that might be literal physical labor or not. But it definitely means that you have to supply a meaningful contribution versus strictly waiting for a handout for nothing. Now, meaningful contributions can be a wide variety of things. It also means that how people think about work and the value of work can change. In the financial system that God outlines for the Israelites, it wasn't focused exclusively around gaining wealth or by squeezing out every last bit of productivity for each worker. Wealth could be used as a tool, there was no doubt about that, but with greater wealth often came greater responsibility. It was more of a tool than the goal of work. Our capitalistic system that we live in now would have to be upended almost completely and couldn't fit into this model. Now, I've given this a lot of thought over the years, because if I had to pick a new career, I would have gone into robotics. And I think that's a fascinating field. Robots have been around for decades, obviously. But it's only in the last handful of years where they've reached a point where they can kind of learn new tasks. Now, we're all familiar of seeing big industrial robots at a car factory or on a line where they're just doing rote tasks over and over again, that they're programmed to do specific things. But that's old school now. Things have gone light years from where that is. One cool example that I saw was there was a worker in a factory that was assembling some things and then packaging it up, and there was a robot watching her do these tasks. And when she was ready for the robot to learn something, she touched a spot on the arm, and the robot watched her do whatever it was she was doing. And then through machine learning and through cloud computing, whenever that robot saw those similar things in the warehouse, it was able to go and do those tasks by itself. I mean, that's incredible. But it also makes me think about the future, and probably the not too distant future, where the nature of work is gonna change. If a robot or a machine or automation can replace most jobs, what kind of impact is that gonna have on our society? One of the economic podcasts that I really enjoy discussed this very thing, because you can already see how destructive this can be for the whole system when you just use something like driverless cars or something that is a relatively small subset of our economy can still wreak huge financial repercussions across the board. But in the financial system to come in the millennium, we have something really interesting taking place. Let's turn back to Isaiah chapter 65. Isaiah chapter 65. Now, what we're reading here can be applied in both a physical sense with physical human beings, but also in the long-term sense when we're spirit beings. Because obviously when we're spirit beings, we don't have to work out in a field to feed ourselves. The nature and quality of work will be changed. Isaiah 65, starting in verse 20. Isaiah 65, starting in verse 20. It says, "No more shall an infant from there live but a few days, nor an old man who has not fulfilled his days." So this is still talking about physical people, obviously. "For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree, so shall be the days of my people." And then get this. "And my elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands." Verse 23. "They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth children for trouble, for they shall be descendants of the blessed of the Lord and their offspring with them." What a change it will be when people can focus on meaningful work that they long enjoy. What challenges them, what helps them learn and grow, and not have to be tied down to a dead-end job just to make ends meet. The financial system that God intends is where people can recover and bounce back from financial ruin, where money is the tool and not the goal, and where options for truly meaningful work are available to those that seek it. Well, as we start to wind down here, I want to turn to one of my favorite scriptures in Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. We're going to start in verse 1 of Acts chapter 17. It says, "Now when they had passed through these two cities, they came to Thessalonica." That's Acts 17 verse 1. "Where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And then Paul, as his custom was, went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and demonstrating that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, 'This Jesus, whom I preach to you, is the Christ.'" Now, I find it very likely that Paul discussed a whole host of things with them, of course, all from this foundation that Jesus Christ was and is the Messiah. And if that's the case, you can go through all the fantastic things that this will mean when Jesus Christ returns. Three Sabbaths is ample time to go through the scriptures we've read today and tie them to Jesus Christ and these amazing promises to come. Verse 4, "And some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women joined Paul and Silas. But the Jews who were not persuaded, becoming envious, took some of the evil men from the marketplace and gathered a mob and set all the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason and sought to bring them out to the people. And notice this next verse. I think this sums it all up for me. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, "Those who have turned the world upside down have come here too." Those who have turned the world upside down have come here too. The way of life that God brings, his way of life, is drastically different than what they were experiencing 2,000 years ago. And it's equally drastically different to what we experience now. When Jesus Christ returns to the earth and the millennium starts, there will be complete, wholesale, widespread changes through every aspect of their lives. The world will quite literally be turned upside down. But even in an ideal world where men and women put together the best plans that they can, they spend generations making iterative changes and improvements, even then, it still pales in comparison with God's plan and his way of life as he changes the very hearts and minds of his spiritual family. No human being could ever fulfill the complete picture that we read about in Isaiah, because ultimately, even if the world was running great, running smoothly and wonderfully, even then, we still need the kingdom. We still need the place that God has prepared for us and the place he has prepared for all of those that choose to follow him. But does that mean we sit back and wait? Or do we take the principles that God has outlined and move the ball forward inch by inch? And in conclusion, the British government founded a very peculiar office in 2010. It was called the Behavioral Insights Team, or BIT for short, but it very quickly acquired a kind of more fitting nickname, I think. It was called the Nudge Unit. And it was unusual because this governmental office was tasked with using nudge theory to improve the lives of the UK citizens. Nudge theory is a way to proactively reinforce people to change. They use small positive reinforcement, kind of indirect suggestions, and small incremental steps to impact large changes over time. And they had a string of successes, impressive results, like getting people to pay their taxes on time. They developed a way to just gently nudge people into paying fees, and they end up saving the government over £30 million a year or something like that. Even simple things like getting people to add more attic insulation so that the nation's energy load would be reduced. Small things like that at an individual level added up to big changes over time. And this nudge unit was so successful that various forms of it were implemented in a whole bunch of different governments, including the United States. They did the same thing. And even the military itself tried to do a nudge unit. The military, in one example, had an issue where only 44% of service members were saving for retirement. And on the civilian side, it was double that. So they use these concepts from the nudge unit to try to incrementally change it and use tactics. And sure enough, by using this nudge and small incremental changes, they got enrollment to nearly double. All of these people are big believers that small incremental changes can lead to big positive changes over time. And sometimes, as it has been proven over the years, when people work really hard on a difficult problem, they can slowly and iteratively change the trajectory in a huge and positive way. Well, what about the huge changes that God will implement in the millennium? Is it possible to start even now and slowly get closer to the principles that God shared with us, or are we left waiting? When Jesus Christ came in the flesh, he didn't just point to a time in the future when God will fix everything and say, "Well, I'll see you in a few thousand years." Instead, he used his time as a physical human being to improve the lives of those around them and to give us principles and examples we can use within our own lives as we live as a light on the hill. But those are just changes individually. Can we also move whole systems to be closer to God's ideal? The principles of God's life and his way of life are timeless. He gave the Israelites concrete physical steps to take in designing and implementing their judicial and financial systems. And in the millennium, he's going to likewise do the same thing. change those systems to accurately reflect his process and his way of life. Well, what about now? Is change possible? Well, I look forward to hearing the answers in 15 minutes.